program. Tonight it is again my pleasure to present Harry Badger, one of our early pioneers. Last time when we stopped our discussion, I believe we were talking about the history of the Chinatown site. What started the Chinatown site?
Well, the Hendrickson Belt had a trading post on the other side of the Tanana River from the Chinatown site. But when they made a strike of gold up here, they moved across, thinking that they would have the real town there where there'd naturally be a courthouse and officials here. They claimed that they couldn't get up here with a steamboat, that the water was too shallow, and that you'd have to stop there at China. Well, they didn't. We blew out a log jam up the river and to let more water into this slough, and when Judge Wickersham came over here, he decided to put it here, and that was the start of the Chinatown site. But there was quite a town there. A lot of people went down there when they thought that that was going to be the permanent town. There was a lot of people there. Then they finally made a strike on Esther Creek, and that's right across the hill from China. Well, we heard it up here that they'd made a strike down there, Mr. Bonifield and I, and we were just packed up ready to go across over to Bonifield country. And we said, oh shucks, nothing down there, that's just China trying to boom for themselves, and there was one of the richest creeks in the country. We wouldn't go near it. There was all kinds of ground open then. We could have gone down and staked anywhere on it. We didn't do it.
That's where the dredges are today.
That's where the dredges are today. And we, you want to go on with the...
I'd like to know a little bit more about what was at China when it was in its heyday.
Well, there were two or three stores, just like any other town, with a population of probably 600 or 700 people.
Really?
They had saloons and gambling and all the trimmings that go with a frontier town when they open up. It was all there. And they had good restaurants there, good accommodations, or hotels, lodging houses, you know, and all that sort of thing. And it was quite prosperous at the time.
It wasn't as picturesque, the changing of the town from China to Fairbanks, as it was when they changed the capital in Minnesota from St. Peter to St. Paul.
No.
Another thing that I think we'd all like to know about is, when did you start your homestead?
1916. I've been up there 35 years.
Did you file on it and prove
yes,
up
ma'am.
In the,
yes,
the usual manner?
Yes.
Where did you get your strawberries, the first ones that you're so famous for?
I got those
for?
From old John Charlie. He's a Swiss gardener, and he had a garden and hothouses over there where the FE company is now. And he went outside and brought in over the trails outside strawberry plants. And I took him over to the hill over here where the cemetery is and showed him where he could get wild plants. He wanted to make a cross with wild plants, and he did. He dug up plants there and made a cross. He made 400 or 500 crosses before he got what he wanted. And that is what I've got now. He wouldn't let us have any plants until he left here. And I didn't get any until about the 1st of September. And I got 3 dozen. I paid him 2 bits apiece for them. And there were 7 of those plants lived. And that's what the strawberry patch is up there now, and the strawberries all over the interior from that patch of berries.
I wonder how many strawberries lived, that the plants lived, that he brought in over the trail.
Well, there was a good many lost, but he raised them in the hothouse. He put them in, he had them all, each separate plant, planted in a little square box. He picked them up and put them inside in the wintertime. He tried the first ones he got, he planted them outdoors, and they all died. Outside berries, outside plants, they all died. And then he took them in and petted them along until he got them blooming so that he could make the cross between the wild ones and the tame ones.
One of the stories that people hear about Alaska is of these tremendously large strawberries. Have you ever heard or seen of these strawberries, or is that just another Paul Bunyan story?
It's kind of a Paul Bunyan story. They do get nice and big, but they're not as big as the sharpest that we used to raise outside. But they are a good big berry, but they tell about strawberries that will only take one or two to fill a teacup. And old John, he did have some exceptionally big berries. He had a wonderful chance for fertilizer there. And they were big. He had, I think he put 9 berries in a box, and he paid it $2.50 a box for them. Got it.
That was worth doing. Before we started this recording, you told about a trip that you and several other people took into what you call the Bonnefield country. Could you tell us a little bit about that trip?
Yes, yeah, so we went down, the 4 of us went down, John Bonnefield and Dr. Stearns and a man by the name of John Oblesser and myself, and we had to go down to the mouth of Wood River to go up. That's the only way we could find our way in there. There was no trail across country like there is now. Never been anyone across there. So we went down there. It's about 40 miles below here, down to the mouth of Wood River. We didn't know where the mouth was. So we camped one night when we thought we were getting pretty well down, and Mr. Bonnefield went ahead. See if he could locate the mouth of the river. While he was gone, we put camp on an island in the river. And the freeze up, when it was freezing up, the ice had piled up on the front of this island. It looked perfectly safe. We went up there and put up our tent and came down to lash our sled. Turned around to go back, and Mr. Oblesser was in front of me and Mr. Stearns behind me, and all of a sudden it was about 10 feet square of ice went out from under Oblesser's feet right down into white water.
Oh my.
And I threw myself flat on the ice and grabbed his wrists. As you could see, his nails digging into the ice as he was slipping, gradually being pulled down. And I grabbed him by the wrists and I called to Doc Stearns to grab my ankles, and he threw himself down, grabbed me, and we hinged ourselves back with our elbows and knees and pull him out. And that's all of us do that. It was
just a lucky chance
that we didn't all go into it. It could have been just that.
That was quick action, the way they say first aid should be.
Yeah, it was. It had to be done very quick.
How did you travel when you were going over into this country?
Well, we had two dog teams and carried our outfit on them, and we didn't do any riding. We just mushed the dogs, but that way.
What do you live on when you're taking these long trips
through
the country?
Usually at night when we'd camp, we'd cook up a pot of beans for our lunches the next day, and the rest of the time it'd be flapjacks and bacon and beans and rice for a change, lots of tea. And drink coffee much.
Well, that explains another question I had in my mind as to what you carry with you on your trip. I'm wondering if you recall any of some of the amusing incidents that happened in those early days.
Amusing incidents?
Amusing incidents and human incidents.
We had one coming down the Good Pasture River. I stopped one night to trade for some caribou meat. It's an Indian camp. There was just one Indian there, and the rest were in the hills. And I made the trade, and then he wanted me to show me some money that he'd got from white men. He showed me first some silver, and he held it out in his hand. He said, "The white man say this much. That right?" I said, "Yeah, that's right." Next, he got out a handful of bills. "Count that," he says. "White man say this many dollars. That right?" "Yeah, that's right." Then he went down into a third pocket and he brought out an old-fashioned Canadian penny that's almost as big as a silver dollar and weighs just about as much. And he said, "White man say this gold, $10. That right?" "Oh no," I said. "You savvy $1?" "Yeah, I savvy $1. Also, it's 100 pieces like this." I said, $1. He went up in the air. I said, "You tell me what he looked like. I'll get it for you when I go to town, and when you come in the spring, I'll have the money for you." And I did. I had the money for him. Of course, I made a lifelong friend. Well, he had a brother. His name was Guinness, and his brother's name was John. He came in two or three consecutive years, and he'd always had a lot of small skins, and John would have five or six bear hides. So I asked him one day, I says, "What's the matter with you, Guinness?" I said, you don't catch any bear." I says, "John all the time got bear. What's the matter with you?" He says, "By and by, no job."
That was putting it short and sweet. Were there any other incidents that you recall?
Oh, there were quite a lot of small things that happened, nothing of any particular interest. I don't know if we're pretty near the end of the string here, aren't we?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Well, you ask some questions and I'll...
I think one of the things that the housewives would like to know would be what kind of stoves you had in these cabins that you had to put up in 30 days.
Well, they were usually Yukon stoves, and if we couldn't get a Yukon stove, we'd take two coal oil tins and cut them in two and put them together and cut a stovepipe hole in and then get another tin and make a pipe out of it. We'd use that. That was it.
That was your stove. When did the first stoves come into the territory, the real stoves?
Well, I don't know. Barnett had a lot of them. He brought a lot of them with him when he came here and established his trading post. He had stoves and everything of that kind. Oh, I'll tell you another kind of a funny story. There was an Indian came up from the Chena camp to buy an outfit. He had $30, I believe, worth of meat that he'd sold to Barnett. And Barnett wanted to know what he wanted. Well, he took a half a pound of tea and a plug of tobacco, and a couple of sewing needles and some thread. I'd only used up about $3-4 of it, and he said, "What do you want for the rest of it?" Well, Barnett had a great big string of brand new big tin dish pans, and you could see yourself in it. They were so bright, you know, just like a mirror. He said he believed he'd take the rest of it in dish pans. He wouldn't let him have him. He talked him out of that.
He was going to look at himself all over the place.
Oh, yes.
I think it would be interesting if you'd start when you first came into the territory and tell us what you did. I mean, what your business was.
When I came into Fairbanks or into the north, into Dawson?
Well, into Fairbanks.
Into Fairbanks?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first business was I was appointed town recorder.
Town recorder.
And the rule was that anyone who wanted a lot would go and stake it, and at least the town recorder would show him where he could stake it. Then he would record it with the town recorder and pay him $2.50. Then it was up to him to build a cabin on it within 30 days in order to hold it. Then it became his. There was no other deeds or anything about it. I have still some of those old recording deeds yet in my possession up home. And that was quite lucrative because there were hundreds of people coming in. I used to take in as much as $75 a day. And then lots of times when they found out that really there wasn't any pay streak here at that time, Lots of people left, and if they had a cabin built, they'd come and sell it for $15 or $20, anything they could get. And I'd buy it, and the next time a man wanted to stake a lot, I'd sell him that cabin and raise the ante, maybe $25 or $30. So it worked out very nicely for
you. Were in the real estate business.
Yeah, the real estate business, right there.
And then you prospected?
Oh, yes, we prospected between times all the time. When I couldn't go prospecting, any of the money that I made, I grubstaked somebody to go out in the hills, and I've got porcupine boilers scattered all over the valley here where they've gone and tried to sink a hole and didn't find anything. They never did any of them find anything.
Well, I see our time is almost up, and that doesn't cover nearly all the things that Mr. Badger has done since he's been in the territory. He certainly had a varied and colored life here in the north. And we of the College Community Women's Club certainly do thank you for taking part on our program. This is Mrs. Nick Idem, and I will say good night.